Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thungathlitz and welcome to the latest episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast Lockdown Tapes. I am your host, as always, Molchar. And on this episode, we're focusing on something that's been published at the moment and looking ahead to the future, where first off, we're chatting to Tom Foster, who's the artist on Judge Dredd, A Penitent Man, which is the Judge Dredd thriller that's running at the moment in 2000 AD, written by Ken Nyman with colour by Chris Blythe and a pencil... letters by Annie Parkhouse. Meanwhile, we're also chatting with Arthur Wyatt and Pi Parr, the creative team on Intestinauts, which has a new story coming out in May in the Prog. I thought I'd get the three of them together to chat, and we go over everything from their work on the strip, the nature of Tharg, 1960s movies, and everything in between, really. So it was lovely to be able to just, you know, have a bit of social contact over lockdown and talk to people. It's a nice, relaxed chat. So thanks very much indeed to them for that. Not much preamble from me this week. I hope you're all staying pretty safe. So we're going to crack on with the chat with this creative trio, Tom Foster, Arthur Wyatt, and Pi Parr.
I want to get you all on because talk about things that are running now, but also things that are running in the future. And first off, I want to talk about Judge Dredd, A Penitent Man, because Tom, this is your triumphant return to the pages of 2000 AD, and it's your first multi-part Dredd, yeah?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. So for those of us who haven't picked up the latest 2000 AD.
Okay.
You want to just give us a non-spoilery rundown of why the you know, what situation does Dredd find himself in this week?
Yes. What's the story about? It mostly kind of centers on a former judge called Kyle Asher, who's served his full sentence on Titan and has returned to Mega City One to try and kind of reintegrate himself into society there. And he kind of catches the eye of Dredd, and Dredd takes a kind of particular interest in him because he's so unused to seeing judges return from Titan and actually try and kind of rebuild their lives. Also the SJS kind of get involved in it all in sort of their usual kind of sinister way. So it is kind of a character study. It's not an all out kind of guns blazing epic type deal. It's quite a sort of self-contained six-parter, and it's quite low-key and understated, which I kind of like doing that stuff because I always respect a bit of subtlety and what can be quite a outre medium. So it's a kind of neat little portrait of someone who's, you know, got a bit of a shady past, which we don't know a huge amount about, it is a bit of a drip feeding exercise in terms of storytelling, but not in an unsatisfying way. It's nicely taught.
Well, because this one's written by Ken Nyman, and in his previous Dredd stuff has been, it's been great. You've clearly got a great style for writing Dredd, but this feels almost like Ken's doing a bit of a, almost like a Wagner pastiche, in that as you say, it is quite, the pace is relatively slow. You know, it is properly eking out the situation. It's quite noirish. I'm interested in when you get a script through for something like this, when you pick up on stuff like that, consciously or unconsciously.
Well, this was quite an odd and interesting one from my perspective, because normally when you do or at least in my experience, when you do a multi-part storyline, you tend to get a kind of overview of the whole story. And then you'll get your kind of chapter breakdowns in script form. But you'll usually have some idea of what the kind of payoffs are going to be, what the resolutions of things are going to be. But with this one, I only ever had the current episode script to go on, really. I think I did get scripts 1 to 3 in fairly quick succession, so I could skip ahead a little bit after maybe the first few weeks. But when I started on it, all I had was the first episode. And it's kind of a tricky situation to be in with a character like Judge Dredd and a character like this, who is, you know, a kind of a disgraced lawmaker who has been kind of defrocked in, you know, pretty unceremonious circumstances. And it's quite a difficult tightrope to walk. You've got to be careful with stuff like that, because obviously the temptation is to draw parallels between the Dredd's world and the circumstances under which we currently live, where there are abuses of authority going on, in quite a sort of scurrilous way. And it can kind of temper how much you want to align the audience's sympathies with anybody in law enforcement, or with, or particularly people who have abused their authority. But then you've got a story here of somebody who's kind of coming back from having fully served their 20-year stretch and under some pretty harsh conditions. And, you know, I do believe in rehabilitation and stuff. I'm not a hang-em type guy. But I found it a little bit difficult to decide on what tone to take. And I hadn't done much work with Ken Neiman before either. I think I've maybe done one short Dredd story with him, maybe two, but I think just one. But it was, I didn't know really that much about his writing or whatever, so I was kind of a little bit in the dark as to where everything might be heading. I don't feel like my trust in the story was betrayed in any way, I'm glad to say. I think things, it seems at the moment to be a fairly kind of intelligent and thoughtful piece at the moment. So but it was a tough thing at first to kind of decide exactly how sympathetically I wanted to portray the people in the story, you know.
Now, based off the video you did for us, come out 4 years ago now, for the From the Drawing Board series that we did, please tell me you've simplified your process, because yes. For anybody who hasn't seen that, go onto the YouTube channel for 2000 AD and have a look, because it's hilarious. But also, my God, man, you were torturing yourself.
Yeah, that's why I stopped that. Well, that was part of the reason. To be honest, if it had just been because it was an onerous process, I might have stuck at it for a bit longer, because if it had a material difference on the quality of the work for the better in the long term, I probably would have stuck at it. But the problem with it was, like you say, it was very labor intensive for very little return in terms of improving things. It was basically like stabilizers for the first few years of my career, because I wasn't confident enough in my drawing ability to sit down and draw everything from scratch and be assured in the idea that it would be a professional level by by the time I got done with it. But it was, but the problem with using being that reliant on 3D models and stuff is that your drawing ability does kind of stagnate quite a bit. And I found that when I was doing conventions and stuff, you know, I would sit there at a convention and draw from the minute the doors opened until the minute the doors closed. And I was, my drawing ability was developing more over the course of one convention than it maybe would in a month or two of using the 3D software and kind of tracing over it and just like putting a few flourishes here and there where I felt like, you know, confident enough to do that. So now, like, I'm not that much quicker yet, although I do feel like I'm speeding up. But now I just do a rough, I draw pretty much from scratch. I'll maybe use some photo reference and stuff, and very occasionally use a 3D model for reference for some things. But I'll just like draw a print size rough version. So the size it's going to be reproduced at, I'll just sit down with a pad in my lap and draw that out after doing some very quick thumbnails. And then I'll blow that up to A3 size and trace over that rough, tightening everything up, putting in the details. And then I go straight from that to inks. So it is still quite time consuming, but the results I think are way better. And the story I just finished yesterday or the day before, I'm doing a one-off for the sci-fi special. And that's the first time really in those six pages that I felt like I was kind of in control of the drawing process the way that, you know, a professional should be from start to finish. There's not like 3 out of 6 panels on every page where I think, that's, you're letting yourself down there. You know, it's the first time I've felt consistent without the assistance of the digital models. Not to say that the Judge Dredd story isn't really good as well. You should definitely go out and buy that. But like, you'll notice there are better panels than others. You know, I'm still kind of finding my feet a little bit, particularly with what I was doing at the time, you know, trying to actually output material at a decent, you know, clip, which I hadn't really done up until that point.
You did take the comparisons with Bolland a little too seriously in terms of the number of pages you could put out in a month, didn't you?
Yes. Well, that was, I kind of figured that my logic was, well, if he took that long to do it, it would be folly to think that I could work at an accelerated rate and produce the same kind of quality. What was actually folly was to think I could produce the same kind of quality at all. After sort of reading into his history in comics and stuff a little bit more, I was forced to confront the fact that there were times where he was outputting, you know, a page of pencils a day, at least notionally, you know, for a while. Like the first few episodes of the Camelot 3000 series, he was having to pencil a page a day. And his early days on like Power Man and stuff and all those things, he was having to work really quickly. And I kind of figured, well, you do kind of have to get your hands dirty when it comes to drawing, at least initially, before you can start saying, oh, well, I need lots of time on this one. You know, you kind of need to be able to get all the mistakes out of your system before you can be too precious about stuff. That was my sort of, if it was a mistake to work so slowly, that was the biggest mistake about it, was trying to present something that was perfect right at the start of my career, which just wasn't going to happen. I needed to kind of do the nitty gritty nuts and bolts of it a bit more first before I could allow myself that kind of largesse. Now, of course, I've arrived. So I can be precious. No, I'm still trying to speed up, but yeah. Sorry, I'm going on.
Absolutely, no need to apologise. What I'm interested in is because you've got a particular style based on your process. And Pi, you're somebody who's is
get it out.
I don't want this to sound in any way insulting, but you can be a lot quicker. You seem to have, you know, from the off, your style, which I seem to recall you, you still did pencils, but you seem to have refined your style very quickly so that you are able to produce a lot of pages. Because the Realm of the Damned stuff that you did, the first book of which ran in the magazine, I mean, you were, I recall at the time, you were properly hammering out pages, weren't you?
Yeah, that's kind of... I sort of jump backward forwards between digital and pencils, really. So, although I do kind of get caught up, like Tom was saying, a bit caught up on the process sometimes of just doing it a certain way because you feel like you should, or So I'll generally sort of start off and I'll bang out a load of thumbnails, just like stick men, to work out sort of compositions for panels, and then I'll go and draw them in pencil just because I feel I kind of concentrate a bit better. I don't like sketching on the computer particularly. And I normally draw it on hundreds of different bits of paper as quickly as I can. So, you know, heads here and there and stuff spread out everywhere. And more than I need as well. So that when I can come to, I'll scan it in and crop it nicely so you can get some nice compositions without, you know. And I'll end up losing a lot of drawing, which is why I don't bother too hard with my pencils, really. And then I ink it all digitally afterwards. I normally do kind of 3 pages of pencils a day, something like that. But like they are scrappy. They're not, you know, they're probably like Tom's page layout.
You say that, but I've seen some of the previews of the Intestinauts story that's coming up. And I really was very impressed with the quality of the work on that. Like that preview image that you put out of the sort of squad car type things with with the tail lights strobing out of them and everything. It's just beautiful. And like, I can't wait to see, cause I'll get copies of these ones. So it would be great to just like luxuriate in that artwork. I think it's amazing that somebody who works like so much faster has like such a brilliant command of form and like lighting and everything. I just thought they were fantastic.
Oh, thanks, man. That's very much appreciated. Yeah. You know, I mean, I have shamelessly picked and chose the pictures I've put online because there's just as many crap panels as there are good ones. And that is one of the better ones. But yeah, no, I can sort of, I suppose I can ink it. I can do sort of 3 pages of pencils in a day, but then it'll take me a day to ink it and probably another half day or day to colour it in. That's the thing that really slows me down. I don't know how any kind of professional colourist does it because it takes me forever.
But you're sort of basically painting the whole thing. It's not just colour overlays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of colours hire a flatter as well.
Sorry?
A lot of colourists hire a flatter as well to do their flats for them. So
yeah, I suppose, yeah.
And then, like, there's various arsehole writers who keep on requesting all kinds of weird overlay stuff.
Yeah, that was the most painful, actually, in the last series, Intestinauts, is that panel where one of the robots, like, fires up a sort of screen display of the map where they're going. And I drew this whole panel with loads of background and 3 guys all crowding around and all their little diodes and sort of pistons and stuff. And then thought, I'll make the screen kind of see-through because that'll look cool and like lasery. But then I realized that if I made it too transparent, you wouldn't be able to see what it was. So I ended up just covering half of it. And that's what I've done, like loads of those street scenes and stuff I've done in the latest series. I've covered them with like adverts, which looks really cool. But I spend half a day drawing these backgrounds and then cover them with adverts that I've then got to design as well. So most of the sort of pictures have got like 3 layers of crap we just don't ever see. Yeah.
That reminds me very much of the video that Tom did where you know, you spent ages. I think it was a wicker basket in one of the Dread panels, and when it got printed, like half of it was covered by.
Was it? I don't even remember.
Something like that.
I do remember spending a lot of time on that wicker, but I think the letter managed to avoid covering that one up. But there's certainly been times where, you know, I've filled the background with Easter eggs and stuff. But you kind of you know before, you know, the letter is going to cover some stuff up. So that's always a bit of a you know, a bit of a guessing game as to where you can try and sort of figure out where the speech bubbles are going to go in advance. But it's very rare that I've felt genuinely like they've covered up something important or that I spent, you know, way too much time on. Well, I mean, I spent way too much time on everything. But they've done a pretty good job so far.
I mean, there's also an element of slight difference in subject matter here, because, you know, a Dread story, whether it's by Wagner or Nyland or whoever, has a certain pace to it, has a certain expectation about how, you know, how the storytelling is going to unfold. Whereas with things like Intestinauts, that's just meant to be, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, that's just meant to be action, action, action.
Mm. Yes,
yeah, Arthur seems surprised by what I just said. I don't know what.
Okay, so it's definitely action, action, action. I'd say one thing I kind of do with it, and others may disagree, is I try and take it very seriously, almost to the point of it being a bit melodramatic, because it's, you know, the subject is so fluffy and, you know, inherently comedic because it's, you know, little tiny poop robots. So I take their dramas very seriously and try to put as much into them as possible. And the combination seems to work out.
I mean, it's one of those things about 2080 is that the... There's very rarely a time when it feels as if the a strip doesn't have the right artist on it. And I'm kind of conscious, particularly with Intestinauts, because was this something that you just were given by Tharg, or was this something you...
Me and Arthur, I think I'd like put something on Twitter about... My missus was working away at the time, and I'd made like myself some revolting Frankenstein meal out of the freezer, which was a combination of like naan bread, noodles, and pizza. It was like just this disgusting, and we just started talking about how I was going to die of food poisoning, and it kind of went from there. Really.
Yeah. The origin.
That's the creative process. You've got to start with food poisoning, and then a story pops out.
Yeah, no. So we pitched to Tharg in the usual way, because I can't remember. You know, I was still working in the office when the first one was commissioned, wasn't I? Yeah. We put it to Matt and asked him if we could do it, and he said yeah. So.
Yeah, I mean that's it's pretty much always been a pie strip in my mind. It's like it's no other artist or form would work with it.
Tell us a little bit about the forthcoming return, because I believe it's going to be in the prog in May. So for those who haven't experienced the product of Pi's digestive tract, his creative bile, as it were. Explain what the Intestinauts are.
Well, it's spaceports. And spaceports are incredibly exciting and culturally diverse places, but they are also involved in their coming together of food and cuisines. There's also a coming together of intestinal parasites, which is why you need Intestinauts, a fully automated gut safety robot defense squad that you'll just take in pill form and it'll go inside you and sort everything out. And they're all little tiny robots, each with their own personalities, that just want to go on these suicide missions, die, and get themselves re-uploaded again as soon as possible to go out on the next one.
I should say, I don't think we've ever successfully had we've never shown a successful mission, have we, so far?
I mean, we've explained it a bunch of times. But, yeah. I feel like I got to put in like an increasingly shorter explanation of the alleged intestinal process each time. And each time they end up somewhere slightly different, like sort of crawling around on someone's ball sack trying to jump into a toilet. But it will work sometime. It works absolutely every time, 100% of the time, most of the time.
You see, initially when it started, I thought, oh, this is like Banzai Battalion. From Dread, but this is much more like an ABC Warriors, really, isn't it? It's just with lots of poop.
Yeah, I mean, like I play it almost like miniature ABC Warriors, but in poop. But to them, it's not poop. It's the natural battlefield, and they are fighting with honor against the disgusting enemies, who are, you know, tapeworms and stuff.
So, Pai, tell us a little bit about the visual language of this, because there's obviously there's a lot you can be very obvious about with this, and there's a lot you can't necessarily be very obvious about. So I'm interested to whether you drew on the lessons learned by the film Inner Space from the 1980s, which I felt very neatly. I think at one point there's a sex scene or something.
Really? I haven't watched it. Oh, hang on.
I'm going to have to correct you there. There's no sex scene in Inner Space. There is a makeout scene where the little vehicle that Dennis Quaid is piloting gets sort of transferred over to somebody else. And there is the revelation that that person is in the family way, but no, Inner Space would never lower itself to having.
I'll tell you what, Arthur. That is an idea, though. I think.
Yeah, I mean, we could just rip that off. I mean,
exchange fluids in that way would be quite exciting, I think.
Yeah, I'm putting that down. yeah, isn't that a Disney?
It's Spielberg executive produced. I think maybe it's Disney. No, wait, it wouldn't be if it was...
Spielberg would never... would never do that. Maybe Isaac Asimov would. I don't know. He was kind of a perv. because he did Fantastic Voyage, it's not a random. I think that was actually a pie question, wasn't it? But I think our main difference is our whole sort of environment seems to be a bit less liquid, which I'm not sure how that works biology-wise, but we just kind of go with it. Because everyone's got a tunnel system inside of them.
Yeah, I try not to think about that too hard, really. Like, if I try and sort of work out actually how big they are or what they're floating in, then it kind of becomes impossible to draw a panel. You know, if they're always floating in murky liquid, they can't see anything, or, you know, that you can't. I'm kind of constantly sort of thinking when I'm doing this, well, how big actually are they? Are they like a tenth of a millimeter big, or are they? You know, I mean, do you have an idea for that, Arthur?
I think we've kind of got a gentleman's understanding that we are never going to question that ever. I mean, we did for Infestnauts, we put them in size enhancers so they'd be slightly bigger, but we never really explained how big they were before or after that. So.
No, I think it's best to just not worry about that and, you know, wallpaper over the cracks.
I mean,
as far as like sort of what body parts to show and stuff. I mean, like in the last one, I remember having a conversation with Arthur about, because we had the guy having a wash with using the sort of dermatological cream in the shower, And I think I was initially thinking he would be like soaping his balls. But after it's like, no, I can we just make it somewhere less distinct? So we ended up with I think it was an armpit, but it could have been anywhere. Well, but then that kind of, you know, made it funnier at the end, really, when you got like a full shot of the guy's bum.
Yeah. Also, that one was like a road trip, so they had to go from somewhere to somewhere else to.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Story. Otherwise, they'd just be like, "Oh, there's the loo. I'll pop off now."
I always think it's one of the wonderful marks of 2080 that you know we can have on the one hand a serious kind of police procedural about, you know, bent coppers and redemption and all this and the other, and then the next minute there's literal poop jokes.
Yeah, no, and that's always one of my favourite things as well. And artistically, you know, you'll go from something that's very kind of realistic looking, like, you know, like Tom stuff, to someone like Disraeli, who's so stylistic. It's just, and they, you know, I love that sort of change as you go through the issues.
I think both my stories I've done with Tom have been horrible pun based.
So. Yes, I
so. There's sort of like the dark and serious thing you're doing right now versus a very bad pun about bears.
That was my first dread as well. That bear one. Oh. Yeah. That's the one I was working on when I did the from the drawing board video as well. You can see the artwork in it. That sort of thing's up my street. I kind of like that collision of very serious, ridiculous ones within the same comic. It reminds me of those sort of take a break style magazines where if you just... all you have to do is read the headlines on the cover and you've been through an emotional roller coaster. I love that sort of there's so many kind of ridiculous ways that and ridiculous dread stories. I'm always kind of on board with those, particularly when he's just kind of protagonist. He's like, the complexity of the satire of dread is not really called upon too much. That's the time to get kind of silly with it and stuff. Whereas if you're going to get serious, you have to kind of address some of the more horrible issues going on in the society in which he exists. So I always like those really mental ones. The other one was the mummy one, right?
The wrap up.
Wrap up. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. That was. Was that the title of the story and the sort of ending flourish pun?
It might have been the title of the story, the ending flourish, and the cover strap line, which is some good recycling.
That was a great cover as well. I can't remember who did that one. That's terrible, but like that was really nice because I kind of fancied doing the cover for that issue. But I would have done the exact same type of thing, but not as well. So it was brilliant. I can't remember who did that. Does anybody remember who did that?
I should remember who did that. But I think I was halfway thinking it was you.
Wasn't it Neil Roberts?
Yeah, I think so. It was definitely a painterly one, and it wasn't Alex Ronald. I think it was Neil Roberts. It was brilliant. That's one of my favorite.
Yeah, that's 2017 because we just did like a half price sale on the digital. Here we go. Hang on.
This is riveting stuff.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Neil Roberts. Hang on. For those watching on.
Oh, nice.
Hey, right, yeah, I forgot about that one. Yeah,
brilliant, that one. Neil's amazing. Neil does loads of covers for Commando as well and always makes me feel kind of very insecure when I do Commando covers because he's just... You always assume that Neil's Commando covers are like vintage ones that they've pulled out like the classic ones that they've pulled out for to reuse, like the Jordi Penalva ones and stuff. And then you find out that, you know, they're contemporary ones that have been done for a very small commission rate. And it burns me up because I spend ages on my commando covers and they're nowhere near as good as his.
Someone did actually.
He's got a little bit more practice.
Yeah, oh. I guess. But he's just bloody brilliant.
Well, I mean, let's talk about puns there, because particularly on Dread, they are a fundamental part of the strip. You know, even on like serious stories like the Lemming Syndrome and, you know, Sunday Night Fever and all this, there's always just that little bit of wordplay, and it always manages to particularly with the kind of Wagner and Grant heyday, always manages to be both silly and serious. And I kind of like what Arthur was saying about playing stuff completely, you know, when you're telling a joke, play it completely straight. Mm-hmm. So that, yeah, you know, it is a pun and it is rather silly, but it's not that kind of knowing, wink, wink, we're telling a joke kind of thing. And I just wonder what, you know, whether anyone thinks that that's kind of the secret to 2080 success, really. You know, it's like you can be humorous, but actually there's very little that's been out and out, like intended laugh out loud funny kind of thing.
I mean, there's definitely levels. I mean, there's different kinds of Dread strip. Trying to think if there's any funnies in Day of Chaos, and I'm drawing a blank. But I think with Dread in particular, there's a real temptation because he's like an ultimate level straight man. He's just like, and he's not unfunny. He's just like super deadpan with everything. I mean, half the shitty dad jokes that come out of Dread, he actually says himself, but it's all like flat and deadpan as hell.
Like he's making a very serious observation.
Yeah.
This is a rap.
This is a rap. It's like he did that deliberately, but at the same time, he's not going to give you a hint he's making a joke.
there's that wonderful moment in, I think it's the first episode of The Penitent Man, where you've got those three panels of a guy from who's come back from Titan and Dread staring at one another, and it's basically the same panel. And there's just the one in the middle, which is utterly. There's no caption. There's no speech bubbles. It's just like a pause.
Yeah.
And for me, there's an awful lot of comedy in that moment. You know, it's a serious moment, but it's a funny moment because you've got these two people staring each other down, and there's something ridiculous about it.
Well, he's too, what's the word? I can't think of the word, but he's too sort of archetypal a character to take 100% seriously. Like, I think, I mean, that's maybe an oversimplification, because obviously you've got characters like, you know, Batman and Daredevil and stuff are similarly pretty kind of straight, and I don't think Batman and Daredevil have necessarily suffered that much from the fact that they've not been written, they've not ever really been written as out and out comedy characters at, you know, post the 1960s.
But, I was going to say,
yeah. But like, there's not really been, with Batman, there's not really been the same kind of collision of super serious and super ridiculous. There's been serious, more serious versions of Batman and less serious versions of Batman, but you would never have super ridiculous lame jokes in a very serious Batman story. Whereas with Dread, it feels like it's kind of more of a free for all where you can get away with anything, because it's a sign that the people who are making it aren't necessarily taking themselves too seriously. And I think that's to the good. And I think that's why people have an affection for 2080, is because even though it sometimes has a tendency to stray into very kind of dark and somber territory, there's always that sort of dissenting voice in there that says, no, we know, you know, we know that that there's a slight ridiculousness to some of this. Yeah. Not that that ever, like, I mean, sometimes stuff will be played completely straight and it will be all the better for it. But I think the fact that there's, even the fact that it's edited by an all-powerful alien, still in this day and age, you know, I think that there's something quite kind of charming about that.
When I first started at 2008 as the sort of junior designer, the guy who's brought on as the head designer before me, Graham, he came from like a proper publishing background and he was very grown up about everything. And he absolutely hated that. He couldn't understand why grown men would... do they really think that there's an alien editor? I'm like, no. No, they don't. Like, he said, who are these fucking people who read this magazine that think this guy's a good idea? And like, he hated it. And it just... I think that was... He was wrong.
Remember the 90s when everyone thought they were over Tharg, and no, they were not.
That's right. Yeah, he got taken away, didn't he, for a while? Yeah.
Everyone was like, oh, we're going to be a serious Vertigo-type comic, no, it needs Tharg. It needs Tharg at the heart of it.
What I find interesting about the taking away of Tharg is that rather than just get rid of the concept completely, they replaced him with the Men in Black from the Vector 13 strip.
So TV is the X-Files.
Exactly. But so that rather than actually challenging the notion of whether you should still have a fictional editor, just replaced him with something else. And of course, it wasn't as popular because Tharg is Tharg. Everyone's used to Tharg. I wonder what the reaction would have been, what the status would have been if I think it was Dave Bishop, had just gotten rid of the fictional editor completely.
Oh, just replaced it with his own voice, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, he'd like that, I think.
Because it always strikes me that you know, the magazine, the editorial in the magazine is just Matt. You know, it's his monthly little missive, and it's not as long and not necessarily as detailed as it is every week in the prog. But you know, I do kind of how long has Matt been Tharg now? 20 years?
I started in 2002 and he'd been there a couple of years before me, so yeah, 20 years.
So he's had to do one of those one of the nerve center things every week. For two decades.
I remember many years ago he was already saying, like, oh God, I don't know what to say as this guy again. Like psyching himself up at his desk. Come on. I am mighty.
It's not like he doesn't have enough to do as it is.
No, that's right.
He's only got the two, you know, periodicals and, you know, every other piece of thing that comes along.
Yeah, I mean, it's all done by droids anyway, so...
Yeah, robots.
It comes in and goes straight out again. There's nothing in between. But going back to the strips and everything, particularly with The Penitent Man, I'm struck by how a story like that can plug into 45 years of continuity, and yet still you don't necessarily need to know all of that continuity, because, you know, all the Titan stuff goes back to the return of Rico in Prog whatever. For me, to a certain extent, it's the same with something like Intestinauts, where, you know, you're creating a world and it works on its own basis. And I wondered what your respective opinions about that was, whether is this something unique to 2000 AD? Is it something that is just good comics?
Intestinauts is about 40 pages total at the moment. So it's got a ways to go. Hoping to build that up a bit.
Well, but, I mean, you know, in terms of world building, it works in of itself, you know? No. All the elements.
I think it's like Dread in a way, I say, putting myself in like the shoes of John Wagner, etc., is a similar great. It's like Dread in that it's got a very simple core concept that it just strays from wildly, but never, or hopefully never loses sight of. And I think it could keep going for quite some time doing that, just getting increasingly further from what it does as its core, but always coming back to it. And that core is, you know, it's got the spaceports thing, and it's got the commoditization of these robot personalities. You could say there's some subtext there about late stage capitalism and the gig economy and other things. I'm not going to go that deep. I'm just going to sprinkle. It never needs to go too far from that to come up with something interesting. And I think that's why it's got legs. I think there's a lot of series that do a thing where they have a first arc that's kind of very focused on something, and then they kind of reach for something else after that and just completely fumble. I think we're staying out of that problem, since we're never going to run out of intestinals or stomach bugs. We do not have a Trader General to kill off. Maybe we should do. Maybe we should go after BattleBot Prime.
Physical corporate war.
This is war.
Tom, what's your feelings on it? Because obviously, you know, like I said, the Penitent Man plugs into a lot of history.
I suppose it plugs into certain key points from the history that are kind of fairly basic principles that once you know them and sort of accept them as being part of the lore, then you can kind of understand it fairly quickly. Like, I mean, I'm not that well schooled in Dread history. I mean, I was aware of, you know, the Titan colony and stuff, and the SJS and all that stuff, but not, you know, I've not read up like tremendously on the history of both of those, but I understood the basic principles that, you know, the body modification and the you know, what the SGS are like as an organization and stuff. And you can kind of, as long as it's something that's fairly kind of, that you can communicate to a reader in fairly simple terms quite quickly. I don't think it feels, like you say, I don't think it's bogged down in the history. I don't think it's necessarily unique to 2000 AD, because there's lots of comics titles that wrestle with the fact that they have this tremendously complicated history. And sometimes being self-referential about that works out very well, like in the case of something like Kingdom Come or one of those series that's very kind of reflexive, or it can work out very, very badly and come across as very kind of cluttered and like there's no entry point for, you know, a new reader. But I don't think 2000 AD and Dread in particular tends to fall into that trap too often, like, because usually you can sum up all you need to know that about whatever past events have occurred, you know, in a few lines of exposition. I don't think a new reader would feel completely lost, you know, in pretty much any case, as long as they start on part one of a story. I think they'll be up to speed pretty quickly usually. And that's definitely the case here, because I'm not I'm not somebody who's read every issue of the comic or whatever, but I was on board with it very quickly. You know, there wasn't anything where I kind of felt like, all right, well, what's this whole story element? You know, I'll need to look up a bunch of extra reference or whatever. It's pretty straightforward, I thought.
It's interesting. I last week I was I'm trying to clear some space because I've had like all the stuff we ever worked on when I was at the Prog has been slowly putting cracks in my ceiling for a long time. And the thought of having to, I'm not going to move house, but the thought of having to move it again from one loft to another, I thought, I'm just going to get rid of some of this apart from my favourite. And I had a mate who said, oh, my daughter quite likes, she reads a lot of manga. She's about 13. You sort of, can she have some? I was like, oh, yeah, great. I'll just pull her out a load of stuff that I loved as a kid. But I didn't really know where to start with Dread on that because, as you say, I went in blind halfway through. You know, when I started reading, I was 12 or 13, and that was in the mid 90s. So there was already like a decent wedge of history there when I started reading it. And you just get chucked in at the deep end and work it out, or fill in the blanks in the way that you do. Is that you think, you know, things seem more epic or more interesting when you're younger anyway. But yeah, I can't remember what I chose for in the end. I went with Mechanismo just because I liked that as a kid. Just Colin McNeil's art on that is just ace. Everything all sunny and yellow. I love all that sort of era. What else did I hear? America, just because, you know, America.
Yeah. I mean, if you're coming in on the 90s, that's two very good places to start.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll see if I can find a Blockmania just because that was always my favourite as well. But yeah, like Tom said, I think all you need is a couple of lines of exposition and then you can kind of, you're up to speed anyway. The premise is quite simple. Yeah.
I've always liked Titan as a, you know, not that there's anything wrong with the stuff that Rob did with the, you know, blowing it up and et cetera, et cetera. But I've always liked Titan as a kind of out there thing, you know, a thing you don't necessarily ever see, because it's for me, it's kind of a cipher for the brutalism of the system, you know, the how unforgiving the judge system is, because it, you know, this is how it treats its own. Mm-hmm. So you can't expect any mercy either. So whenever, you know, it was McMahon, wasn't it, who did all the facial stuff for when Rico came back. That's just a wonderful piece of like grotesquery. Mm-hmm. That just, it works because it says, you know, it is exactly what the process that it's had to do. It is a brutalizing, dehumanizing process, and you see that. You don't even need to read the words to guess what's, you know, what's gone on with him. So I've always loved Titan as kind of a thing that pops up every now and again, doesn't necessarily need lots of explaining.
Well, the facial stuff that you were talking about there was kind of a weird thing to, it was difficult to know how far to take that with when you've got like a character who's in most of the story largely focuses on them. And you are supposed to kind of at least be able to have some sympathy with the character, even though you don't really know what their past is exactly. And it took a wee while to kind of figure out how grotesque to make the character so that they weren't kind of visually off-putting from a reading point of view, but also so that you weren't just kind of chibifying them and making them, you know, really slightly too kind of romanticized. When they, you know, they are supposed to have gone through some pretty horrendous, you know, disfigurement, really. Go on.
I said, didn't Inferno kind of scale it back to just they have robot noses? And then,
well,
it's been back and forth since then.
It depends, because sometimes they will get in. There will be events that happen during their stay on Titan, which will necessitate further surgeries, which may be something that has happened in this character's past.
I think I liked about the McMahon design is it seems to actually go like up and inside of them, like you can see right up their nostrils. And that I guess you could just put the robot nose on as a sort of cap to that.
you know, if you want to get kind of all literary and historical about it, of course, the cutting off of noses and ears was traditional punishment for things like slander and, you know, libel and whatnot. So it's and, you know, disfigurement in fiction has a long and sometimes inglorious history. You've only got to look at what Bond villains have looked like over the years to see that. But I like it because it just encapsulates the whole thing for me. So it's always interesting to see, you know, as you say, Tom, where you draw the line, literally, as regards that disfigurement and that, you know, the effect that it has on the character.
In this instance, I think ultimately what it came down to was just trying to keep it. I kind of abandoned any idea that there should be too much of that you should scale it back so that the character would be more kind of sympathetic because they're more visually relatable, and just kind of went more for practical things. Like, what would be distinctive over a bunch of pages where you could see the design and go, okay, that's not just any returned Titan inmate, that's specifically Kyle Asher. And also, like, so not so overcomplicated that it would be a nightmare to draw again and again, but just enough little distinct touches that that, you know, it would be that there would be some kind of personality to it. So that was what ended up kind of dictating it. And I sort of left decided not to kind of overanalyze it too much on a kind of moralistic scale.
Well, so that's the perfect guide to comic art, isn't it? Make sure one guy's got a big bushy mustache. The other one always wears a hat. That woman is always, you know, has a certain hairstyle, and then you always know who they are. Except,
if you're as useless to drawing different faces that I am, then you need that sort of crutch.
Well, it doesn't help when half of your character's face is lost to surgery. You know, trying to make them still have some personality in there can be tricky.
I think I always like when I'm scripting things, and Dredd in particular, is when I write Judge Dredd looking shocked, and it's like, how would you know?
Yeah.
He's really raising his eyebrows at this one.
That's what Carl Urban had to do, wouldn't he? He had to basically act with his mouth, or at least learn to, in some way, shape, or form.
He got an impressive lip curl in there.
I don't know how he did it, to be honest with you, because Dale, what's his face, from Wayne's World? He used to get cramps in his face from all the curl his lips, didn't he?
Who's this? Sorry,
you know the and the guy who wasn't my
from
Wayne's World, Carvey.
Yeah. Huh. He used to get horrible cramps in his lips from lip acting.
You mean that's not his normal facial expression? He goes to the store and talks to people in the morning with. He is kind of permanently face locked in the role. That's gotta hurt.
Well, I think Dana Carvey fancied himself as kind of a kind of chameleon, a comedy chameleon, because he made that movie, The Master of Disguise, where he plays like 8 or 9 different roles in it or whatever. Each one was a kind of homeopathic dilution of any kind of vision or quality that film might have had if he'd stuck to playing one, which is often the case. With the exception of Kind Hearts and Coronets, I don't think there's many films in which one person plays many, many, many roles that actually stand up to scrutiny.
I think you're being very mean about Eddie Murphy there.
Obliquely, yes. But no, it's first Nutty Professor film's actually all right. At least as good as the Jerry Lewis one. Like, and the Jerry Lewis one's all right. It's got some good jokes in that. I'm not taking away from the joke. But, like, comedy movies from the 60s aren't necessarily, like, powerhouses from start to finish. They've usually got, like, one or two decent moments in them. And then the rest is kind of, you know, a 10-minute scene where one person's just sitting on a bed and talking on a telephone with no changes of shot or anything. And then something else happens. Like, there was a really good, sorry, this is a bit of a tangent. There's a really good review video of the original Ocean's 11 movie, the Rat Pack one. And it points out just how often it's just like a shot, a static shot of like Sinatra just having a telephone conversation or Dean Martin having a telephone conversation, and nothing happens in the whole scene. It's a really dreadful movie, that first Ocean's 11 movie.
Yeah, I mean, like, you got Sinatra and Dean Martin. They've got a lot of charisma. You can just get away with that, maybe. I don't know. I have not actually seen it.
If you're Fred Astaire or Gene Kelly, you can get away with the camera not moving for 10 minutes. But to be honest, I don't think either Sinatra or Dean Martin were particularly bothered about being all that charismatic during that particular film project.
It didn't break into it like a holiday themed musical number at any point.
No, there's no musical numbers in the original Ocean, despite the fact that it's peopled almost exclusively by singers.
And that just sucks.
Yeah, it's a dreadful film.
My favourite 60s comedy film is Blackbeard's Ghost with Peter Ustinov, in which he plays a character who is drunk throughout, and it's great.
What, Peter Ustinov playing a comedy drunk? Surely not.
I mean, was this method?
You could say it was the part he was born to play, so...
Yes. No, I haven't seen that one. There are good 60s comedies, absolutely. Like, but 60s is a bit of a bleak era for cinema in general. Like, there's the standout movies, like your 2001 Space Odyssey and stuff like that, but there's so much rubbish. Just like formulaic Westerns and movies that are trying to be the cinema equivalent of sort of rock and roll or you know, Andy Warhol or something, and just disappear so far up their own fundament that they're unwatchable.
That's very unkind to Casino Royale.
Oh, God, yeah. Casino Royale is a great example of that type of movie. It's baffling to watch now.
I mean, everyone involved had a lot of fun, by which I mean drugs, so...
Yeah, that's... God, let's get off this topic, because I'm going
to... I was just about to say, this is weirdly turned into one of those movie podcasts that I always...
Let's just list movies and why they suck, and everyone who likes them is wrong. Because liking things is wrong. You shouldn't.
No. I know. I don't mean to get into personal subjective movie. 80% of 60s movies are almost unwatchable. Let's move on.
But the 70s are great.
My favorite era of movies.
Yeah.
Coming back into comics. we'll wrap up in a second. Tom, you mentioned that you've got a dread in the summer special, the sci-fi special.
A dread. It's not a dread.
Oh, it's not a dread. I thought it was a dread. Sorry.
No, it's Dread Universe, but it's not dread. I don't want to... I don't know how much I'm authorised to say at this point. Okay. But it's... it's a character I haven't drawn before, but really, really, really enjoyed drawing for this one.
Okay, that'll keep a few people guessing. In terms of Intestinauts, like I said, the new series is, the new story is going to be out in May. You've got a handful of stories under your belt. Is the plenty of more Tales of the Intestinauts still to come.
Yeah, we've got one in particular, haven't we, we want to do.
Yeah.
I mean, involving, go on.
I'm going to say it's in the hands of Varg and his beneficent mercy right now. But yeah, we have some stuff. We have a slightly longer one pitched, which will be fun to do if we get to do that, because it'll give it slightly more space than the thriller format, which I've liked, but kind of want to burst out of.
Is it going to be gross?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the answer that I wanted to hear.
Super stuff. Well, thank you indeed to the chaps for chatting away. We should be back in 7 days' time when, we're going to have more from the Galaxy's Greatest Podcast. Thank you for all the feedback that we've had over the last little while. Really glad people enjoyed the chat with Tiernan Trevelyan, and thank you again to him for enduring an interview with me. So see you in a week's time. And until then, Earthlets, stay safe, keep taking care of one another, and Splendid Verthrig.